now listening to Soundspace, the podcast where we explore the space of sound.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Soundspace. I'm here with Q. How's it going, man?
I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good.
Awesome. I'm going to start off the topic today with a quote. Are you ready?
Go ahead.
It's from Sylvia Massey.
All right.
So we're going to be talking about the role of the producer, right?
Let's do it.
And when she was asked, she said these words. She said, "The job of a producer is to make the artist as comfortable as possible or uncomfortable as needed." What do you think about that?
Comfortable or uncomfortable as needed.
Yeah.
Nice. I like that. I haven't heard that phrase before.
I am paraphrasing.
What do you think she means by that?
Well, she's one of those producers that's kind of known for like wacky antics in the studio, as in she, like the example that she gave in that interview was like, I once hung the singer of System of a Down upside down to get a proper like vocal take out of him, and he almost died, so we didn't use that take in the end. But she was like, you gotta sometimes, depending on the type of performance, you gotta push their limits in one direction or the other, because like a singer is being vulnerable with you, and they're very like naked when they just like sing, this is my song, I'm just gonna sing it in front of you.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's very like you're bearing yourself a lot. So she's like, you have to make them comfortable, but you also have to know what buttons need to be pushed on them, like based on your knowledge of their personality. I really love this interview. I found it like,
I haven't heard it. Maybe we could put a link of that for people who'd be interested in listening to that.
Totally. Yeah.
I haven't seen it, so I, you know, you can tell me a little bit more about it, because I'm kind of intrigued by this a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I like that. I like that theory. I like that idea. You know, just like, obviously, I worked at a recording studio, and I know you have to make the artist as comfortable as possible, but making them uncomfortable, that seems a little backwards to me. But you know, like that's curious to me. That makes me interested in to know what result that comes to.
I mean, to be fair, she makes a lot of angry music, you know, like, so sometimes, like, if she's pissing her artist off on purpose to deliver an angry vocal performance, that makes sense to me. So
right.
I think that's why she gave the asterisk of as needed, you know, it's like, this depends on the situation.
Yeah.
But her thing seems to be, because of like the genre that she works in, her thing seems to be make them mentally, you know, like emotionally comfortable with you, but some sort of like physical uncomfort or discomfort, sorry, to distract them from the fact that they're standing in front of a microphone and there's a big red light that says recording in front of them. Cause that's when people freeze, you know,
yeah.
That's when people go, oh God. So she's like, it's your job to distract them.
Right.
Which sounds like a bad thing, but she's like, you have to make them forget that they're recording right now. Because if they're thinking about the fact that, oh God, people are going to listen to this for, you know, 10 years.
Yeah.
Or, you know, infinite time, however long.
It stresses, you know, somebody out for sure.
Yeah.
What I used to do, it's a little bit like sneaky, but I would tell them, oh yeah, no, we're just doing like a test roll. We're just like, oh, I'm just adjusting levels.
Oh, me too.
I'm just adjusting levels.
I do that exactly.
And then like, no, it doesn't always work, but it has happened where they were doing like adjusting levels. They were doing a test take and it turned out to be the best take. So we ended up using it.
Every time.
And they were kind of like upset that I was recording, but then happy at the end that was actually, you know, that ended up being used. So
yeah, it's funny. There's a range of there's a roller coaster of emotions at that, because
yeah.
At first they're like, what? You've deceived me. How could you do this? And then yeah, after, once
the thing
like, they
that.
See the final product, they're like, dang, like yeah. I didn't know I had it in me.
The thing about that is you can only do that so many times to one artist. You know, you can't do that more than once. Because then eventually yes. They're going to be like, yeah, you're fucking lying to me.
Well, not exactly. I have a strategy for that.
Do tell.
Because I record a bunch of takes. And then I, like, they're not able to see the screen, like, the way I usually have it set up.
Right.
So I'll be like, okay, well, you know, let's just do a warm-up, but a sacrificial take, you know, this doesn't matter. I'll record that and not say that I did, exactly like you said. But then we'll just jump straight into the real takes. And then when we're, you know, they come in to the control room and it's editing time to pick the best take, I'll listen to that initial take. And they'll just assume that it's one of the real ones, you know?
Yeah. Yeah,
so like they're none the wiser that I have actually recorded. And like I think of three specific tracks that I've released where we ended up, the bulk of the vocal edit ended up being the scratch, quote unquote, the fake scratch.
Right, right.
It's a very handy trick. It's so manipulative.
It is, but you know what? Like you said, sometimes you have to do that. Actually, I'm not sure if you said that, but you definitely implied it. Sometimes you have to do that to kind of like shake them up, to make them comfortable, to get the best result from the artist.
Yes, definitely. This is one of, I'm sure, you know, we could touch on, there's many roles that a producer has, but sort of putting them in the right mindset is I guess the first one that came to mind when I, at least watching this interview.
Right.
But she talked about a lot of, she was talking about budget, she was talking about, you know, knowing when, she said, left to their own devices, an artist will tinker with the mix and try like, oh, let's punch in on this part. I could do that better. I could do this better. And they will never release it. It will just stay in the vault forever. And you have to be the one to say, no, okay, like this is, I know your abilities. This is as good as it's going to get. It's time to release it and just force them to stop.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it's difficult for an artist to really, to decide that on their own. Like sometimes, you need an outside opinion, an opinion that you can trust, especially because you're always going to be self-critical of your own music, your own creations.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember there was an interview with Brian May, the guitarist of Queen, where he talked about over-evolving, like, okay, as a song. He's like, there's a fruit-like quality to it. Where it, you know, it's not ready yet, it's not ripe yet, and then it comes into fruition, literally, if I'm going with this metaphor, and then if you wait too long, like it's kind of wilted away.
Yeah, for sure, it can easily become overripe if we're using the same analogy.
And listening to once he said that, I felt like I heard it. I mean, I wasn't producing yet at the time; I was like 14. But listening to when they came into their own as a band, like a few albums in, and then versus the early stuff, I could see back then they didn't know how to call it and say, okay, this one's done, let's just get it out. They would just keep on. They said they ran through the tape, like they were multi-tracking over tape. They said they ran over it so many times that it started to become transparent, like it physically, you could see through the tape because they had gone over it.
Oh my God.
Just way too much. It was, I forget what I don't know tape terminology very well, but like the magnetic, I forget it. College was a very long time ago, so these terms are slipping.
That's fine.
I believe that was the last time I used the tape machine.
I definitely understand what you mean, though.
The magnetic particles were being like stripped away, basically.
Mm-hmm.
What was I? I was on the path of saying, oh yeah, okay, so we're talking about role of the producer. And this is something, the reason why I wanted to talk about this, what made me think of it, is that I was having a conversation recently and I realized that the term has become so fluid and it has changed so much over the years that
there's producer? Always,
producer.
Yeah, definitely.
There really is every single time a follow-up question. Like if you're like, oh, what do you do? I'm a music producer. Oh, okay. I mean, are you like just making beats?
Yeah, I think that's often confused by beat maker. Like I've met many people that are like, that have told me, yeah, I'm a producer. And I'm like, oh, okay, who have you produced? Oh, nobody, I just, you know, make beats. I'm like, okay, then that's fine, you know, that's cool. But that's not a producer, right. That's a beat maker. And there's definitely a difference.
I mean, if
there's a difference.
A million people are calling making beats being a producer, then I guess that's what it is. Like you just have to sort of use that language. But
okay, well then, if that's the case, there has to be a new word for producer, because there's definitely a distinction between making beats for your own creative, being fully creative in the process, or being a producer. You have to sometimes compromise.
Yeah.
Well, actually, most of the time you have to compromise, because it's really the artist's vision that you need to see and that you need to realize, right?
Right. That's the thing, is that I've accepted the fact that the word has just diluted out into a bunch of different, very different things that range from, you know, you're reading books about, oh, the philosophy of production, and you know, here's how, you know, Sylvia Massey, like here's how to like mentally get in the head of your artist and explore it, to help them explore their inner artistic selves, blah, blah, blah. And then there's people just like throwing some samples together and it's like, oh, I made a beat, I'm a producer. Like, there's those two extremes.
And there's no shade. And there's no shade to that at all. It's just,
right.
It's different.
It's different. And I think that, I mean, I'm down for a new word. I mean, there kind of already are. There's kind of already distinct, like, oh, I'm a mixing engineer.
I've heard like sound engineer. Yeah, yeah.
Right. It's kind of like, there's a debate happening within the sphere of classical music right now, because mm-hmm. if you're speaking to someone who is, you know, educated or at least a fan, like familiar with it, classical music refers to a very specific era of Austrian, you know, generally European music over an 80-year period between mm-hmm. like 1680 and 1750. You know, it's like super specific and very narrow definition. And then if, you know, to a lay person, right, like just someone who's not familiar, classical music just means anything before 1900. Like, they just any type of music other than some guy strumming folk music in his guitar that has you know, a violin, that's classical.
Yeah.
And that's a breakdown in, you know, terminology. It's like the classical musician is going to go, no, that's not that's a Baroque piece, no, that's a Romantic piece, blah blah blah. So so the debate is, should we just accept that this is how the term classical is used and then make a new word for to refer to that specific period?
Oh, I see what you mean.
Or do the other, you know, the reverse.
I would kind of hope that it just, like, the terminology stays the same and then whatever comes next has a new name, but because it makes more sense mm-hmm. chronologically, right? Because if you've been calling something classical for so long and then it changes definition, it just doesn't really make sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's confusing. It's like, do you just sort of submit to the broad definition, or do you like dictate, like, no, this is the proper usage of the, you know? So I think same thing is happening.
Yeah, same thing is happening with producers, exactly. For sure.
There's a lot of old school, you know, executive producer types who, you know, come from an analog world mm-hmm. and they have like that very specific view of it. And they look at some kid on his laptop making beats and they're like, it's very gatekeepy, you know, it's very like, that's not a producer back in my day, you know?
Oh yeah. That's,
and then everyone's,
I'm sorry, but that's kind of obnoxious. I kind of hate that. Like, if you don't have like the top-notch gear and you don't have all this and all that and you're not a producer, that's complete BS, because the producer aspect and the creator aspect is all just the creativity of the person. Mm-hmm. What comes after, like what it takes to get there, that's different. But the producer is creatively on the same level as the artist.
Really? You think so?
I think, yeah, definitely. Right,
I kind of see the producer as like the middleman between, like, the artist has like these crazy, like, ambitious sort of indulgent ideas, and it's like the producer's job is to bring them to reality a little bit. Like, don't turn it into commercial, like, blandness, but be like, okay, well, you know, other people have to listen to this as well, so we can't make like a 15-minute guitar solo, you know, like, let's just make it 3 minutes, and then they just make calls like that. Which is why, I mean, I see the producer as like, it's a blend of the business and the artistry, you know? It's like they have to be aware of both and find that correct balance for whatever market you're going
Obviously,
for.
We can agree that a producer's job is someone who can take the thought or the idea of an artist, say a singer, right? Mm-hmm. And realizing it and turning it to life. Whether that be a pop song, rap song, whatever. I think a good producer knows what their fortes are and stick generally to that genre, to that style. You're not going to have a pop producer work with a metal band the following week. I mean, I don't know if that even makes sense, but I hope you know what I'm saying. I hope you know where I'm going with this.
Yeah, I do see what you're saying. The closest example that comes to mind is like a Rick Rubin who, as sort of like a genre hopping, you know, like really versatile producer, because mm-hmm. he was like a hip hop guy and then he was like a metal guy and he kind of went back and forth, and then he produced Johnny Cash, you know, did some country. I think he's dabbled in, you know, the pop world. Okay. Although I can't think of a specific
that kind of contradicts my whole statement, though.
But no, but he's an outlier. Like, I think you're okay. Definitely right in general. Like, people find their lane and then they stick to it. But he's someone that I've heard speak about this specifically. He said, like, spiritually, at their core, heavy rock music and hip hop, especially like underground hip hop, have they're kind of in sync with each other. They come from a similar place, and okay. I really liked what he said about that, because there is a camaraderie amongst music communities that were bred from poverty. I'll say that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why that there is so much crossover, or at least mutual respect, between like the rock and hip hop. You know, there's a frustration behind both of them. It's very like a youthful.
I mean, I can in my head, I correlate both genres as a rebellious genre.
Absolutely,
rock and roll was the rebellious genre of music for the longest time, and then eventually it moved over to hip-hop. Those two in my mind are related in the sense that they're both rebellious, but I don't think they influence one another.
I think you can certainly say that what hip-hop heads and rockers have in common is that their parents are like yelling at them to turn it down.
They hated their music. Yeah,
exactly.
exactly.
That is the spiritual connection between
those two genres. That's where I was going with that. Yeah. Say his name again. What is it?
Rick Rubin.
Rick Rubin.
Yeah, you've heard like 100 records that he's done.
For sure. I'm terrible with names.
Oh,
I'm
you know what? With names. Something just occurred to me. Max Martin, possibly the biggest producer of all time. He used to be a metal guy.
Really?
He used to be in like bands back in Sweden.
Oh, wow.
That's his background. I don't think anything to do with his career has, you know, shown that. But as a teenager, he was singing glam metal stuff like in the 80s, which I suppose translates. Yeah, most people think of glam metal and hair metal as closer to pop than metal, I would think.
Right.
Anyhow, to get back to the topic there, this is a thought that I had. So we're talking about old school versus new school definition of producer. But even if you go back a ways, if you go back to, let's say you're in the 60s, you're in the 70s, mm-hmm. there's a few different, categories you could put them into. Like there are producers that predominantly their job is, you know, I guess you could describe them more as a vocal coach. Like they walk in and that's their main role. And there are producers that are kind of absentee, like executive stuff. Rick Rubin is kind of like that. He's like, allegedly, you know, doesn't spend a lot of time in the studio with the artist. He sort of keeps like a separation. I guess he finds some sort of usefulness in that.
Okay.
But if you think about it, and I was trying to think about this the other day, because this could come off sounding very ignorant. But let's say there's an Adele song.
Okay.
The instrument, it's just like a piano and vocal only. A great deal of her songs are like that. And you're the producer of an Adele song. You're like the head guy. Assuming that she wrote a great song. She didn't need any, you know, advice. There's no like flaw with the song or changes that need to be made.
Mm-hmm.
Assuming that you obviously have an amazing set of engineers at your disposal. They did a beautiful, you know, recording of the piano. It was arranged nicely.
Mm-hmm.
The vocal coach, like her, that she works with, did a great job, you know, like pulling an amazing performance out of it. The mixing engineer is doing his thing. All of these cogs in this machine are working. And I was thinking, as the producer in that role, as the guy overseeing all of this, what exactly is your job? You know what I mean? I know that there are executive producers that are they're listed that way, but they're really just sort of funding the thing, and mm-hmm. they come into the studio once a month to be like, "Ah, how's it going? Yeah, sounds nice. All right, see you in a month," and then they leave.
Mm-hmm.
That's not really what I'm thinking about. I'm just thinking about how the fact that music is such a collaborative process means the producer role, it kind of fills in the gap of whatever's not there. in that scenario. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean.
It's the reverse of, let's say, like if Skrillex is making a song.
Right.
Or Deadmau5.
Yeah.
He's the producer and that's it. Like there isn't 100%, or specifically with Deadmau5, I'm not sure about Skrillex's creative process.
Yeah.
How collaborative he is, but that is like the total opposite end of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
He's not filling a gap or just making sure that there are no issues or just keeping an eye on the budget. Like he is every piece of this project.
Yeah.
So that is the point that I was trying to make about like how fluid a term like being a producer is. Like when a high budget record, my point is like you can outsource almost every piece of actual work to the point that it is essentially just making the big decisions, you know? Like you're probably not deciding which microphone to use on this piano. That's probably up to the engineer. You're not deciding like how long should this vocal run be? That's probably the vocal coach. You know, that like it's just the really large stylistic overarching decisions.
Yeah.
And not that there's anything wrong with that. Like someone needs to do that job. Like there needs to be
for sure
someone in that role. But there's obviously people. If I were to think of someone in the middle, like in between, I would think like a Ross Robinson.
Okay.
Do you know him?
No.
Ross Robinson is an interesting guy because I had the chance to listen to a perfect before and after example.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is that, you know Korn, right?
They're
like a 90s alternative metal band.
Yeah, I know Korn.
They have this demo, Niedermeyer's Mind. I might be mispronouncing that, but anyway, so it's Korn pre Ross Robinson, before this legendary producer that's, you know, credited with the proliferation of nu metal. Before he came along, this is what they sound like. So I sat down and listened to it with all of this Korn music. You know, their first five albums, I've essentially memorized them. Like every sound is just in my brain. So just because my dad was a big fan and then I picked him up again as a teenager.
Yeah.
So I listened to this demo and shockingly, they really sounded like Metallica, but with just a couple of quirks, you know, a slightly different approach to bass and a bit more groove from like the Pantera influence.
Okay.
But they didn't sound as weird and outlandish and crazy and fresh and new as we all know and love them today for. Do you know what I mean? Like I'm essentially hearing what adding Ross Robinson to the mix did to their sound.
That's crazy.
And it was so profound. They went from being like a kind of knockoff-y Metallica band, because there are a million of those.
Yeah.
And then you put on their first record and it is night and day. He's got bagpipes in there. He's got this weirdly like emotionally vulnerable delivery that's just like, the guy's not afraid to cry on stage. Like everyone... That's the first thing everyone talks about is like, wow, he's just pouring his soul out. And there's like a funk influence now. He's slapping, slapping the bass under like distorted metal guitars, which is a combo that was fairly new at the time. And the drummer is just like, it's like the most ADHD sounding drum style I've ever heard in my life. It's so frantic. Oof. But it's not frantic in the thrashy type of way. It's like... It's funky, it's groovy, but he's just constant fills and he's just driving. It's like he's 2 BPM faster than the rest of the band at all times. And they're just like, oh God, and just trying to catch up with him. It's really like exciting and visceral to listen to.
Yeah.
And then they have the gimmick of that first album was combining like sort of nostalgic childhood things. There's a lot of nursery rhyme stuff with a really horrific kind of violent sounds and imagery with like those really dissonant guitar chords that are distorted beyond belief, and all of these things were kind of just appeared in that first album that were not there in the demo. So what I don't think that these were Ross Robinson's ideas necessarily, but what I am saying is that this guy saw this band and I guess must have seen some kind of really wild potential in them. Because I think he pulled their personality. You know, you guys are on time and in tune, yada yada. But like, let's get weird. Like, what do you want to hear in this? What have you never heard before? And then, you know, Jonathan Davis is like a lifelong bagpipe player. I would not be surprised if that was Ross Robinson. Just be like, just put it in there. Just do it. This is you. This is your personality. And 100% as a producer is like, you're often presented with something. It's like, okay, here's my song. And then you go, wow, that's very professional. And that's very well put together. And it has all the pieces. But like, what is some stuff that is so bizarre that you thought, oh, we can't put that in there. Let's do that. And then that'll make you stand out.
Yeah, and essentially you're bringing out the best of the artists, of all the individual musicians to make this masterpiece. But at what point do you think that producer job crossed the line and become, because at this point it's starting to sound a little songwriting. It's starting to sound a little like it's jumping into songwriting and less into producing.
Yeah, they border on each other for sure.
Yeah, and at what point do you think is really crossing that line? Where do you think the line is between producer and songwriter? Is there a line?
I don't know if there
can one be, do either one? Can one do both jobs?
I don't know if there can be like a hard line, like a definition, but I think it is a gray area because I've done songs where, you know, the artist wrote it, I produced it, and I thought, okay, you know, this final cut, I just restructured what was there. Like I said, okay, like there's three choruses, we only need two, you know, let's rewrite this bridge.
Yeah, blah, blah, restructure blah, blah, blah. And stuff like that. That's definitely the producer's job. And
but at the end of that, I definitely was not saying, oh, you know, I co-wrote the song. It's like, absolutely not. This is your song. I just sort of adjusted a couple, you know, there were a couple loose screws that I just tightened this. You know,
and then
there have been songs where by the end of the process, I had contributed so much, like I was specifically writing actual lyrics, redoing the melody of this section. And once I got that involved, I definitely had the feeling, I was like, okay, this is essentially our song. Like it, because it feels like both of us, even though I was not there at its inception. It is so unrecognizable now that it is complete that I felt like I was a part of it. At that point, but I don't know what the line is.
Yeah, that's fine. It was kind of like an open question. I don't know either, and I didn't really expect there to be a clear answer, you know?
I mean, legally speaking, there is a clear answer, but it's something just for copyright purposes, for, you know, who owns the master, et cetera. It is necessary to have a strict definition. And I think that it's a legal definition that a lot of people in the field take issue with because it leads to kind of ridiculous scenarios and, you know, people getting sued. Oh, what was that? It was a Creedence Clearwater revival. The singer went solo, wrote a song that was very similar to a Creedence song, and then got sued by his old label. For, quote, ripping off himself.
Oh, my God.
It's just absurd legal scenarios.
That's
where...
That's crazy.
Right.
Legal schmeagle.
You have to have some kind of... you have to have some kind of, like, hard... This is the line between, okay, you definitely contributed to the writing of this.
Yeah.
But in an abstract, you know, philosophical way, I don't think you can say there's a strict cutoff.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I definitely feel like I should add this, by the way. When I do have those moments of, okay, you know, this line, these lyrics are just not quite there. And then I suggest like a rewrite, like what if we said this instead? I'm terrified of those moments because I feel like this is someone's baby, you know, like they just created this thing and then handed it to you. And then you're like, I don't like this part. I really hate doing that. I know it's a necessary part of the process, but I used to be a lot worse at delivering that information in a tactful way. And this is going to sound very corny, but what made me better at sort of communicating that was, it's like a positivity sandwich, you know, like just sandwich it between two good things and don't, you know, lie, never lie, but like find a thing that you like about it. Say, oh yeah, you know, that's a really solid hook melody you have there.
Yeah.
I think that the verse melody is definitely weaker, and then you say like a third thing that's nice to cap it off. And they, yeah, then they will accept the middle part. They'll be like, okay, I can handle
it. That's the rule of criticism. You have to, it's at least one positive, or is that, what is it? At least two positives and one negative. But yeah, that definitely, it's not even just with producers. That's all criticism, whether it's literature or public speaking or, you know, anything.
Yeah.
Speaking of producers, while I was working at the studio, I got the opportunity to see Glenn Robinson work.
Glenn Robinson?
Yeah, he's a producer. He produced for Foo Fighters, Ramones, Steve Miller Band, David Bowie, AC/DC, like the list goes on.
Ramones? Okay, so he's been around for a while.
Yeah, he's been around for a while. Though when I saw him work, extremely intimidating man, in the sense he's like almost 7 feet tall, I think.
7 feet tall?
No, he's not 7 feet, I don't think, but he's very tall. And just the experience he holds under his belt, like, or sorry, that's not an expression. Just the experience that he holds is very intimidating in that sense. And seeing him work was truly magical. Mm. However, I didn't see him truly produce. He was more an acting engineer for, I think it was like a live stream.
Honestly, being that height must make producing so much easier.
Yeah.
Because people will actually listen to you.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea how many times I've just been like blatantly stiffed? Like someone just, I've decided not to pay you, and then they just like skip town or whatever?
No.
So not saying, to me. I feel me, like that wouldn't happen to me if I was like Shaq height.
Yeah. No, I don't know if I've told this story before or not, but I'm going to say it again anyway. He had asked me for like the simplest thing. It was probably, I think he had asked me to patch in like a Pultec EQ, you know, just something really silly. And I was just like kind of new at the studio at the time. And I knew how to do it. It's a simple patch, but I was so nervous. And I'm like, okay, I can't mess this up, you know, just, and then like, it was just like two cables and it was patched in. And then I'm like, did it work? He's like, yeah, it's good. Cool. And I was like, so relieved from that. But
like forehead sweating.
But like, I was just nervous because of who he was. But that's.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. Honestly, as soon as I see a patch bay, I just start panicking already. Those things are unwieldy. So I can't blame you too much there.
Yeah.
For working with. So that's cool that you got to work with him though. How did that happen?
I mean, not, okay, let me correct you. I didn't work with him. I just got to see him work. what was the connection?
But if you're plugging stuff, like were you like an intern or?
I know I was an assistant at the studio.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So,
so he just came through.
You know, like cabling mics and like patching gear and opening the session or whatever. It's just basic assistant stuff, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that I've gotten a lot of value out of that over the years. I don't know if anyone listening to this is considering, you know, a career, but best piece of advice I can give is just watch somebody. Just go to a studio and just be the coffee guy or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And just watch them do their thing because you'll
That's my favorite thing. That's my favorite thing. I've done it a ton.
Stare at his fingers as he's twiddling all these knobs.
I've done it a ton. Just stay silent in the background. Take your notes. Watch what they do. I wish I did it more with one of my friends at the studio. I think I got to see him work on one project and that's it. He was on our show, Luca the producer. I got to see him work once. I kind of wish I got to see him work more while I was there because he's a talented guy. He's a talented producer. But as for engineers, I got to see, you know, the owner of the studio, Dan Cinelli, mix a ton of records, which was kind of fascinating. And I just had my notebook in the back, taking notes and absorbing as much information as I possibly can, whether it's like a plugin I've never heard of or using a plugin in a way I've never seen being used before, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's so valuable. And I wandered into a place called Gallery Recording Studio in Ottawa, which I think doesn't exist anymore. But it's run by this guy, Dean Watson, who's an awesome guy. Like he's still in Ottawa. I think he moved to a different... Buckingham Palace. That's the name of his new studio. I want to get the name right. And I literally just hadn't... I had nothing but the thought of maybe this is a career that's for me. I was just finishing high school and just in an absolute freak out of what I was going to do with my life. And I thought, okay, I'll just watch people. So I went to his studio, and I was so delusional that I thought I was offering something. I was like, hey, like, I'll help out. And not knowing that I didn't even know what a preamp was. I had no idea which mics need phantom. I was probably wrapping cables completely wrong. I knew nothing, right?
Yeah.
So I walked in, and he was so nice. He was just, oh yeah, you know, come on in. And that's the thing, is that if you're, that's the other important advice of, if you're just going to watch a session in the studio, be fun. Like, just be cool to hang around with, and they will invite you back. Like, they, if you're, you know, like, hey, like, I brought everyone like sandwiches, they'll be like, oh, I love this guy. And then you're in. Obviously, you can't badger them with too many questions while they're trying to work, but just being there.
No,
in the environment.
For questions, I'd say definitely write down everything, write down all the questions included. And then at the end, or at another time, possibly, like, you know, depending if they have time at the end of the session, ask them everything. Say, I saw you did this. Why did you do that? You know, because it's fine, I think, to ask questions that you think will be short answers, but you don't want to disrupt their flow. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'd add to that and say, save your questions till the end. And don't become the guy who just brings food for everyone.
Well, what's wrong with that? I mean, people love food.
I'm just kidding.
You just the only thing is, you don't want to stay that guy. You want to graduate to, like,
yeah,
like, I don't know, assistant, and then after that, like, doing actual, you know, like, renting the studio for your own stuff, and, you know,
yeah,
there's steps. But I think the point is, like, when I went there, I just knocked on his door and said, like, can I just come in and check it out? Mm-hmm. And I guess people pick up on a passion, you know, if they seem like, hey, you know what, you're 18, you seem like you have,
yeah,
you know, a vigor, like an interest in this, and people respond to that really well, I think. So
definitely, definitely.
That's really all you need.
Yeah.
I don't know if everyone is going to be as nice as he was. I'm like scared that I'm just going to be telling people to just go knock on doors, because some people, you know, might be, you know, grumpy or like not open to that type of thing if they're a bit more introverted, but.
Yeah, but fuck them. You know, if people are just going to be assholes to you, it's not even worth your time.
No, of course.
I'm not sure if I asked you this, I mean, I'm assuming since we're doing this episode, you've produced artists before, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. What has been your best or worst experience? Or you can answer both.
Best and worst, eh?
No names, please.
Okay.
So the this guy, Joe. No,
okay. Let me tell you about Jeff. So,
Jeff Bezos.
So the worst was probably this guy. He was a rapper. This might
say no more. Say no more.
Okay, this may get controversial, but he basically had this perspective, because there are a lot of rap lyrics that when you listen to them, you're like, wow, that's ballsy. Like, I can't believe he said that. And that's kind of the appeal of it. It's like a shock.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Eminem has done this back in the day. Kendrick Lamar had to a lesser degree, but has still done this. And I think that that's a great thing, to have like a really just jaw-dropping hot take of a lyric. You know, it's part of the genre, it's part of the art form,
yeah,
at least in certain circles. But I think that what Kendrick does with a song like The Black or the Berry, or what Eminem does with a song like Kim, is that, like, they have this wild, crazy thought. Mm-hmm. And they thought, I'm just gonna put that feeling into a song. But what, yeah, this rapper was doing, just superficially, he saw these pieces of art and he thought, ooh, I'm just going to be as shocking and like upsetting as possible. And he actually explicitly told me that that was his goal. And I was trying to explain to him in kinder words. I was like, this, I'm sorry, man, but that's like the most embarrassing thing I've ever heard in my life. Like, the goal should not be to just upset as many people as possible. The goal should just, if you have a thought that's, you know, a harsh thought, authentically, just organically, then put that in a song, that's great. But for your goal to just be to annoy or piss people off, I just was so turned off by his entire attitude, and we had to do a whole EP together.
Mm.
So I spent a lot of time with this guy. And the best, yeah, let's
be
more
positive.
Yeah,
I can agree with that. Like, the best, some rapper.
You tell yours.
Please. Some rapper, like, I can agree with that. Like, some of the rapper sessions I've done have been a little, for lack of a better term, rude, you know?
Right.
I
a lot of attitude.
It's just a very rude attitude, but it's fine. No, it was a studio when I when I moved here in Toronto, there was a lot of, essentially it was a rap studio, which is, it was very cool. But man, some of these guys that I worked with, they would say one thing, I do one thing, and then after they're like, man, what the hell are you saying? Like, I told you, I that's not what I said. And then they're like, do this, and then I do exactly what they say. They're like, oh no, that's not what I'm talking about. It's because they don't know how to articulate what they want, which is fine, right?
Oh, so they were giving you like a hard time about your doing your job, like on the technical end.
On the technical end. So like, it's fine if you don't know exactly what it is that you want, or even if you don't know how to articulate it properly, that's fine too. You know, I don't expect you to, if you're not a technical person, you're there to create the art. But saying one thing, thinking that you mean that thing, and you don't mean that thing, you mean something else. And then when I do that, swearing at me and like telling me off that I did exactly what you told me to, that's a little rude, you know?
Yeah. There's a lot of stories like that that I've heard, and my favorite of all is, it came from a buddy of mine that briefly worked with Travis Scott, oddly enough. And I think this was,
wow,
this was not exactly pre-fame Travis Scott, but it was very, very early in his
career. That's cool. That's really cool.
He really exploded.
Damn.
And he said, he said that he was just engineering. Like, there was a producer standing behind him, like with his arms crossed, listening, be like, okay, we need to deliver it more like this. That was not his job. All he had to do was hit record.
Track.
You know, hit stop, playlist everything, name everything, keep things organized. He was purely an engineer, right? So he's doing his thing. Travis Scott's in the booth. He's writing. He's like writing in his notebook. He's nodding. He's like, okay, he's got some ideas. And he's like, all right, yo, I'm ready. Let's record right now. I got some ideas. And then my friend, he like goes in the talk back and he's like, okay, real quick, do you want the click in there or not? That's all he asked, right? Yeah. That was the length of his question. Travis Scott immediately takes his headphones off, like slams them on the ground and starts screaming at him. He's like, when I say record, I tell you to record right away. Don't be asking me those stupid questions. Blah, 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 blah. He just started going absolutely off. Like, he was, my friend was on the verge of crying because he was like, I can't believe I'm here. I get to work with all these big man. People. And he's just like getting absolutely roasted. So
that's horrible. There is a, I mean, it's funny, but it's horrible.
From like a brief, by the way, it's a valid question. It's like, hey, you know, there's not a lot of drums in this part. You're going to drift off the beat. Do you want the click in there?
Yeah.
He probably should have just turned it on and go, like, you know, just without asking.
And what did producer say about this?
Oh, I think he rolled his eyes, waited for the tantrum to finish, and then, you know, resumed. Mm. I don't remember what he said, but he said no one intervened, which tells him that this is a frequent occurrence for Travis Scott. He's just like got a huge temper. Mm-hmm. And that is a story that I love to contrast against. There's this video of Michael Jackson in 1985. I think they're recording, I forget what album they did that year, but Quincy Jones is in the booth. Okay. And I think he's engineering himself. Like, he looks like he's, you know, hitting buttons. And you can see both of them in the frame. And Quincy's explaining, like, okay, we're going to do a bunch of layers. So, you know, stand back a few feet from the microphone and then do a take, and then stand back a few more feet and do a take. And they're just going to slowly have a version of each vocal with slightly more room tone as you go, and just stack them all together and get that nice, like, rich effect. That was what they were doing, right? And Michael Jackson was taking orders with like a yes, sir, like no hesitation, nothing.
Okay.
And he was the biggest star in the world at the time. Like, everything he touched was gold, you know, was platinum. He had every right to have a giant ego and be snippy and, you know, Travis Scott-esque, but he didn't. He was just totally cool to work with. I'll say the music that Michael Jackson makes is definitely a bit less hyped up and volatile and angry as compared to Travis Scott, so that might just be their personality, but that is a perfect little juxtaposition right there.
Mm-hmm.
Because you really do not have to, like, overreact to that degree on someone who's like a 21-year-old.
Definitely.
First time in the studio, right? And I don't think he was invited back for that reason, which is unfortunate, because I really wish that the guy behind the decision, like the money, I don't know who it is, Dr. Dre owns the label, I think, at the time that they were working under. I wish someone had stepped in and said, no, he was doing his job, and he did his job well. He's
that's a shame.
This guy, he's a friggin' Pro Tools ninja. He was wild on the Shortcuts. Mm-hmm. I don't think he got any opportunity after that because now Travis just has a grudge on you. So on to the next one.
Yeah, that's a shame.
It was really, it's like frustrating to be that disposable, but
yeah.
It's a cutthroat business, you know?
Yeah. I've had the opportunity to work with a incredibly clear and amazing artist. Basically, I wasn't producing, I was just tracking, I was just recording, I was engineering, but they were acting as their own producer, which, you know, as some artists do. And he would record his takes, and he would know exactly what he's doing. One take, two takes at most, done, comes in the studio, listens, take this, do that, bring that there, cut that out, do this, take that S and bring it to the other one, copy it over. He was just telling me exactly what he wanted.
Isn't it wonderful?
It's wonderful, but I feel like, and it was fine because I wasn't producing it, but I feel like if I was the producer, I would have been a little bit, I would have felt a little happy that it's like going so smoothly, but also like inadequate. I don't know if
that's what we were talking about earlier, though.
The right
is that, like,
terminology.
If everyone on your team is doing their job perfectly, then, like,
yeah,
you don't have to. I there's nothing wrong with being like, you know what, I'm not needed. Like, I could just see this through.
Yeah,
and it's just not. I think that's a wise producer to do that, to be able to let go of your ego to the degree that you don't have to. You're not going to make unnecessary changes just to feel needed. I think that's very detached of you, because, like, there. Mm-hmm. This is something that my one of my favorite profs explained to me, is like, sometimes you got to do a red herring. If you're working with the corporate people, if you're working with folks who don't know much about music, and you're giving them a piece of music for an advertisement or something, make a great piece, and then if you get the sense from them that they have like a bit of an ego, make a great piece, and then just do one thing wrong. Just like make a bunch of, there's like a honking goose in the middle of the song. And then that's a completely terrible example, but whatever. Just make one terrible decision, and then they will listen to it and be like, "Wow, yeah, this is really great." But like that piece there, like we should get rid of that. And then they feel like they're contributing. So now you can get a really solid thing past that threshold of like, there's some guy who has no idea what he's doing, who's in charge of dictating the instructions to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that red herring sort of trick was really funny, because if you were to just present him a perfect thing, that this is the product, you do not need to weigh in on this at all because it is exactly what the assignment was.
It's kind of hard to trust.
Like, he'll just poke at it. He'll be like, I have to say something, otherwise why am I here? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I would totally I would totally respect someone who said, you know what, you did your job, I'm not necessary. So it just passes right through them to the next person in the the chain.
Yeah, definitely.
That requires a lot of self-awareness to do that.
SoundSpace is proudly sponsored by Leza Audio Technologies. Use code SoundSpace for 30% off any purchase. Transform your sound with Glow, a mass granulator, or with the modern degradation of codec by visiting leza.io today.
I recently had the opportunity to produce and sound design the audio for a play, which is kind of fun. Yeah, so no artist, no singer involved, just fully me and my laptop, but it was kind of cool. Like, I just got a set of instructions and like general vibes and moments, right? Feelings with some references, right? And I just went with it, and it was kind of cool. It was the first time I was producing for a play, which was different. That's not really like I said before, it's not really like working with an artist or anything, but in the sense I was working with actors, right? They have to respond well with the sounds, which is a kind of production.
That's pretty interesting. I didn't realize, like, I had never thought of theater as like a world that I would be involved in at all as a producer, but that's pretty interesting that you got to do that.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
So what type of music were they asking for?
Okay, so the play kind of referenced like a Russian Chekhov kind of play or kind of vibe. So I had some of that Russian-y sound. It's kind of in the setting of, I think, 1950s, but it wasn't 1950s. It had like a 1950s tone to it. I mean, I won't like listen to it while I'm on the subway, but you know,
when I'm on the subway, there's nothing nicer than some good old Soviet era Russian music. That's what I say. Really transport me back to the motherland there. So what is different about theater performed music as opposed to, you know, like creating something regularly?
I guess I wouldn't call it regularly. I would call it, because when I think of production, I think more of pop music, rock music, whatever. It's different in the sense that it's a play, so it has to be dramatic, right? You have to have kind of like cliche sounding sounds in there, you know? So it's very dramatic. That's the major difference I would put.
You know what kind of surprises me? There is a much more popularity than I would have guessed of people sitting down and listening to soundtrack music, because to me it is music that, I mean, a soundtrack has to be really mind-blowing for me to just listen to it, because it's designed to accompany something. So it is not it might just be that people...
So you wouldn't just sit down and listen to the Dark Knight soundtrack?
I mean, I like Hans Zimmer and I like, you know, John Williams, but I only like it in the context of the... Like, I love John Williams, but I'm not going to sit on the subway and be like, da, 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 da. Like, I'm not having a heroic moment right now. So it would be... It just feels silly to me. And if I had to take a gander as to why there, you go to, you know, this the Spotify page of, you know, a popular movie and the soundtrack just has millions and millions of hits. I think that there is kind of not a lot of appreciation for building atmosphere or building a soundscape in popular music. There's something appealing about it, and it's generally kind of like wallpaper. You know, it's designed to be paired with some kind of visual thing.
Yeah.
But I think people like the idea of it, and they maybe just kind of crave it for that reason. There's no atmosphere being built in like a punk rock song or like a rapping or something like that. I mean, it's very rare. The only thing I can think of is like a shoegazy sort of genres have like a pretty big appreciation for it. Like, we're just going to build this like massive sounding cavernous wall of guitars and we're just going to like, you know, crush your ears with it. And I think that it has a lot to do, the appeal of that sort of connects to why people like to listen to, like, it's very rare that people will hear a full orchestra. There's not a lot of music that people are exposed to unless you're, you know, an active music fan. That maybe they, I know classical music, like its reputation is, oh, you know, it's boring. It's just like music for studying. But I think people do have like an itch, like they want to hear grand, massive chambers of 100 musicians coming together in a synchronized way and making something that you couldn't with just, you know, a singer and a piano and a couple other pieces.
Yeah.
I think people do have a sort of pulled towards that, and I guess the only outlet for that type of thing is what they're exposed to, which is movies. You know, they watch a movie and they're like, damn, that felt so epic, I want to, you know, relive
that, or be my own main character.
It kind of does like lead into that feeling, doesn't it? The only thing I can think of that I have repeatedly sat down and listened to outside of the movie is Lord of the Rings, because I think Howard Shore is, he's not as, I guess, well known as a John Williams or a Hans Zimmer, but he's, I would say, my personal favorite in the world of sort of traditional approach to scoring a film. I think he's number one in my heart, because even if those movies were not as great as they are, that original trilogy, the music is so perfect. Every character has a theme that is really evocative of what they are at their core, and it makes you uneasy when it's supposed to, and it makes you like misty-eyed when it's supposed to. Like, it just does its job so beautifully.
That's what it's meant for, of course.
Yeah,
I think we could definitely save some of the scoring conversation for a later time, because it is definitely an interesting subject Clearly, I can see you're very interested in it, and so am I. I would be interested in talking about it
more. Oh, we could 100% do a whole episode on this.
I would like to ask you a question, and maybe it could be like our last question, and we can wrap things up. What is one thing you think, what is the most risky thing a producer can do?
What is the most risky thing a producer can do?
What is the riskiest thing a producer can do in the music industry?
Like artistically, something that's risky, as in like just a bold musical decision, just, like, oh wow, I can't believe they did that, or like a career decision.
Musically. I guess both. But I guess my question was more towards musically. But if that's what you're inclined to, if that's the first thing that pops to your head, then I'd be interested in hearing that as well.
Yeah, that's a tough question. It's the riskiest thing that you can do. I'm trying to think of the riskiest things that I've done. I usually push the artist in one direction or the other. I need some kind of overarching, just adjective to be guiding the whole production. Like, okay, this song is going to be very noisy. And I'm like, oh, okay, so we're going to have lots of like lo-fi elements. We're going to have lots of like broken sounding like tape distortion. We're going to have a lot of white noise in there. That's just like describing the aesthetic of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I usually push artists in one direction, like a minimalist direction or a max, yeah, like just to stick out from the crowd in some sort of way. And I usually am the one on the side of, sometimes it's the artist that is going, oh, you know, like let's be bold and do all these creative artsy things. And the producer's like, all right, yeah, but like, you know, let's be realistic. And they're pulling them back. But yeah, most often it's in my experience, I guess just because of who I've happened to work with, it's the reverse. Like the artist will make like, here's a fairly traditional song. And I'm like, okay, but let's make it a bit more bizarre. Let's like really crank up the uniqueness, you know? Because I like, I think, you know, diversity is what makes music interesting. And I want to hear something that I haven't heard for its own sake. So I agree with you. I made a hip hop beat recently that has not found an artist yet. I guess I'm shopping it around, but it's very, very stripped down. There's like two instruments.
It has like a very particular, you have a particular image for it. Is that it? Like you have a specific sound that you want an artist to have?
I'm kind of just inviting a bunch of people to the studio and then just bringing it up casually. Like, hey, this is a thing I made. Does this speak to you? And then sometimes people will drop a verse on it.
Yeah.
Just for fun. And then they'll be like, no. And then we just forget about it.
Mm-hmm.
Once someone comes in and they go, oh, like I get it. I get what you're doing here. Then I guess put it out as some kind of collaborative thing. But I think what's risky about that song is that there's not a lot there, and it's tough to hold your attention with so few elements. Like that's kind of the restriction that I put on myself. It's got like,
yeah,
kick, snare, kalimba, bass, and they're all filtered down so aggressively that there's scarcely anything over like 800 hertz. Like it's just like a like subby thing, and it's like that the entire time until like the last chunk at the end, and then that's the,
so it's like true hip hop.
True hip hop is the yeah, only real thing left, my boy.
No, that's cool. I'd love to hear.
Yeah, I'll show you sometime. That's kind of more on the minimalist end of things. But another time, like I was producing a pop thing that was it was piano, but you know, it was a full production. All the drums and bass and synths were there, and I was like, this needs, is everything's perfect the way it is, but I'm falling asleep, you know, like it needs some kind of spice.
It needs more cowbell.
More cowbell, just needs a kick in the ass, you know. So I added this lead synthesizer that was like the most noisy, like distorted, dissonant, like shrill sounding thing ever. And then I just put it like at the climax. I was like, let's just shove this right here. And then that, the purpose that serves in the production is like, hey, like listen, like don't fall asleep on me. Like there's still some surprises coming.
To kind of create some uncomfort to the listener. To not uncomfort, but like just like shock.
Yes. Yeah. That was what I was doing. And it's really exciting. Like if you just take that chunk, that piece of the song, it's kind of it's a bit much. Like, it's very overwhelming and headache inducing, I would almost say. That sounds like a bad thing, but like, if you're there for the whole journey and you've
built up
to it, it works, you know? I don't know how else to explain it other than that, but if you just cut straight to that point of the song, like if you just click on that chunk and then listen to it, it's like, oh God, this is all, you know, it's too crazy. I felt like a risk that I took that was pretty aggressive, and it took a really long time for her to warm up to it. She was kind of like, whoa, like that's really kind of out of nowhere. And then I was like, yeah, like just let it, just like sleep on it. You know, I was like, this idea just needs to, is brand new right now. It just needs to like ferment in your brain a little bit, and then maybe you'll accept it. And she's like, slowly came around to it, but it took some time. Like it took like a week for her to be, because we had this back and forth where I was going like, I really think it, like it needs something like this. Like if not this, it needs something else that's just like just an extra left turn at the very end, just to keep them wanting more, I suppose. And then it did get included eventually, but I had to soften it a bit. We compromised on the tone, so it's a bit less shrill than it originally was, and there's some other things there supporting it, so it's not just like sticking out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love little risks. I
mean, there's always compromise with ideas like that, for sure.
What about you? What's the biggest risk that you've taken as a producer?
I haven't really taken many risks. No, I guess it's more like structurally. For me, it's more structurally. It's kind of removing sections from their song that I think it's a good section. It sounds nice, but it's too much. So by removing it, it kind of emphasizes the next section of their track. So like, it wasn't this, but for example, removing a verse and going straight to the chorus, you know, and removing some lyrics
sometimes it makes like all the difference. Like it's definitely a call that you got to make sometimes.
It's like, yeah, the song is shorter now, but I feel like it makes more of an impact, and it kind of depends on the song, obviously. Songs don't have to be 4 minutes long, 5 minutes long, whatever. A song can be 2 minutes long and be just as powerful, just as addictive, just as amazing.
Hey man, you're talking to a hardcore, you know, sometimes, punk fan. I enjoy a short burst of the song. But yeah, I totally see what you're saying. Like just pulling out a whole chunk. You know, I'm curious if this has ever happened to you. You tell them to like, okay, you know, like this whole bridge that you wrote, like it's making it into a 5 minute song. It should be, you know, 4 minutes. Let's just take it out.
Mm-hmm.
Has that piece that you removed ever just blossomed into its own song later?
My own personal tracks, but not somebody else's.
Okay. Because I've seen that happen a few times. It seems kind of
Definitely.
Like if you get attached to that idea, you're like, oh, okay, maybe not in this, but somewhere like it has to work.
Yeah, sometimes it's actually happened to me where I've removed a bit in my song where it became the chorus of another song.
Yeah. How much of it, I actually don't even know, how much of your time is spent working on your own material versus, you know, producing for an artist? Like, are you kind of split?
I'd say I probably don't work enough on my own stuff.
Okay.
You know?
Hey man, you got to pay the bills. Like, don't beat yourself up there.
Yeah. No, but like, it's kind of a thing where I want to work more on my own stuff. It's just a whole timing thing, you know?
It's tough to find the time, yeah.
But it's nice working with other artists because, you know, I'm a very creative person. I like creating my own stuff. But sometimes when you have dry bits, dry spells, working with other people kind of inspires you to, like, you probably hear a section of the song where it can inspire you to create your own track later on. I don't know, an idea can pop in your head while working with somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do. I think I'm better in a collaboration context than I am just sort of sitting down.
I'm not better at a collaborative scenarios. Yeah. I rather work. Yeah, it sounds horrible. No, I rather work alone. But
it's like some kind of badass vigilante. You're like, I work alone.
I'm the type of guy who listens to villain soundtracks.
I have moments where I'm alone, where I'm absolutely flying, or I'm like, oh, you know, this idea, that idea, but usually I've heard people say this about me before. You know those propellers that you have to like push and then it just keeps going by itself, and that's how you start the jet plane or the airplane?
Yeah.
That's kind of me.
Yeah.
Like, I will not start a thing left to my own devices. I will just sort of like keep working on things that have already been started. But if I'm with someone and they give me just a spark, if they just like say one sentence, I'm like, yo, that thing you said, that'd be a cool lyric. And then I'll just go. But if I just sit down in a chair, it's like, all right, time to write. I just won't start anything.
Yeah, I know. I definitely feel you. Sometimes like to get the ball rolling, I'll either like slap on a song that I really like or that I'm listening to a lot, or I'll slap on an acapella and just start making an instrumental around it, and then remove the acapella, and then bam, all of a sudden you got your own song. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think that my best work that I did last year, the entire year, was a song that started out as a 100% complete ripoff of just a song that I liked, and I just recreated it, and then I just twisted each piece one at a time, and slowly it became unrecognizable, and then it gradually ceased to be a ripoff. You know what I'm saying? Like, it just, and I realized that that's a process that, I mean, I think it's kind of common. I don't think it's like shameful.
It is common. It's a common practice.
You're stepping on the what do they call it? They say this about science all the time, but it's like you're stepping on the shoulders of giants of the past. You know, you're using genius music that you love, and you're taking that and making it, putting your own personality.
But it's not only that. It's not only that. Like, it's also sometimes it's just referencing other music without copying, of course. It puts that reference in the head of the listener in a positive way. And there have been artists that have done this. And I guess one I could think of right now.
You say Bob Dylan?
No.
Oh, okay.
Because I was going to say, yeah, for sure. Bob Dylan as well, definitely. But I was going to say Miley Cyrus.
Miley Cyrus.
Have you heard her new track, Flowers?
I have, yeah. What was she quoting? I didn't catch it.
So she wasn't sampling. She wasn't. She kind of responded. It wasn't even a response song, but it kind of works as a response to "When I Was Your Man" by Bruno Mars.
Really, that flew completely over my head, even though I know both songs.
Well, yeah, it wasn't, because it was very, very. I don't know if it was very subtle, but it was. It wasn't intended to be a sample. It wasn't intended to be a response. I think the idea was there, but it wasn't fully meant to be a full response. And the melody kind of made me feel more like an 80s breakup song. I can't remember the name of the song that I was thinking of.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a classic, like sort of self-empowering, you know, I'm happy without you, I'm moving on type of thing. I liked the song, but I could swear that I had heard it before. That's the thing, that the reason why I brought up Bob Dylan is because he I think he became kind of known for that. Like, he would grab a quote from this book. He just was reading this book at the time and it spoke to him. And you have a sentence that everyone's heard and everyone's familiar with. And then you put that in a song. But then the fact that, you know, Bob Dylan's very political, maybe it's like some kind of statement. And then he puts this wistful, like, sad guitar on it. And you're like, oh, that makes me view what he's quoting in a completely different light, because the fact that he's combining those two things, those two contradictory things, kind of tells you what he personally feels about what he's quoting. And I love that. I love music that can do that. It's like that. That is how he personally creates meaning in his songs, in a very musical way. I really love it.
Yeah,
and that's something that I'm kind of trying to implement. Yeah, in my own work. There's a philosopher. Have you ever heard of Charles Bukowski?
No.
You know what he's sort of known for? I haven't read his material, but I came across a quote from him. Or it's not even a quote, really. It's just that something that he put on his gravestone. He's like, that's what you're supposed to put. There's the entire essence of who you are. If you're going to put a quote in your gravestone, that's what you write, right? And he just said, don't try. That's all he put.
Don't try.
Don't try. And I think that's...
Don't even bother.
Yeah. I don't know if he's like a... If that came first or if Yoda came first, you know, there is no try type of thing, but I think it's a similar sentiment. Like, he was an author and he was a successful author, so everyone goes, why would you say don't try if you clearly did? And the way I interpret it is, which I think is the generally accepted interpretation, is people will hear, like, you ever hear the expression, you're listening to something or looking at some piece of media and you go, ugh, they're trying too hard. That is the main,
yeah,
that feeling is like the main obstacle for between you and your ability to create something that is really unique and wonderful, is the thing. If you ever have a thought like, ugh, I need to make something clever, it's like, no, you don't.
Yeah.
Stop trying. All the time. Just
I think about that all the time though.
Yeah. That's the recent thing that I'm trying to sort of work into my method, I guess you could say. So just stop trying.
I remember the name of the song, by the way.
Oh, hit me. What is it?
So it's Flowers by Miley Cyrus resembles I Will Survive.
Oh, by Gloria Trainor.
Yeah, exactly.
Gaynor.
Listen to both songs and they kind of have the same vibe. And I don't know if this was the case, but if the producer did that technique, I would imagine that was the song that they kind of were inspired from, for the melody.
It's safe to say the sentiment of the song is identical, right?
Yeah, and when you get a chance, listen to Flowers by Miley Cyrus side by side When I Was Your Man by Bruno Mars. Just like, it's not a reference, it's not a sample, it's just like, it kind of feels like a response.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of funny to go back and listen to those early Bruno Mars songs, because he's had such a switch in his career. Like, he's just like a funk, I guess you call it neo-funk guy now. He has like a lot of soul, a lot of groove, a lot of sharp horns. He's collaborating with Anderson .Paak nowadays. It's wonderful. And he really was just pretty straight-laced pop music back in the day.
Yeah.
And it's so straight, because I love his new stuff far more. I was never into the, what was that big song? Grenade.
Oh, no.
Yeah, did you like that stuff?
Yeah, I did. I mean, it wasn't like, you wouldn't bump that at a party or anything. But
there's always been, I've always had this aversion to a extremely melodramatic, self-serious love song. I don't know why. It's just a combination. He's like this big epic, like, catch a grenade for you. And like all these epic strings come in. And for some reason, that aesthetic of love song, I do enjoy love songs. But to me, love is like it's an emotion that's like a kind of like a quiet, intimate thing. So like, like his, he's saying like, I'm going to jump in front of a train while like epic music plays. I just, for some reason, I can never able to take it seriously.
That's fair. That's valid.
It feels very like, very teen.
Yeah. That's...
I don't know. But hey, I mean, the guy can write a song. Like, who am I to criticize? And he's an interesting one too, because he got his start as a writer. And before, you know what? I'm going to sing this one myself, which is, sometimes there are some instances like that where I'm just so glad. Like, I think Sia wrote Chandelier for Rihanna. Was it Rihanna? And then I think her producers or her label or something turned it down. You know, they're like, this is not really the brand that we're trying to shift her into a more other R&B-ish direction. So this doesn't work right now. And I think Sia's producer was the one who said, oh, come on, like, this is so good. You can't just drop it. Like, you got to use it. So she just, I'll do it myself. And wow, what a powerhouse of a vocal performance.
Yeah, that's a good example of the artist's trust towards a producer. Mm-hmm. Well, I think we covered a pretty large amount of information in this episode. I think this is a pretty good place to call it. All right, everyone, thank you so much for listening. That was a lot of fun. If you'd like to listen to another episode or simply see what we've been up to, you can find us on all social media and all streaming platforms. All of the artwork for Soundspace is done by GoPro Keo, so go give him a like and follow. And last but not least, we are sponsored by Leza Audio, so go check them out. That's it for us today. We hope you enjoyed. Cheers.